coming up on the Get Lean, Eat Clean podcast.
And so in the spring, when hibernating animals are coming out of their torpid winter slow metabolic state, this is called emergence. And so that's where the name of the emergence diet comes from. The idea is, you know, get out of this torpid low metabolic state that I think a lot of us, you know, I'm not necessarily saying like what I actually think, you know, I use torpor as an analogy, right? Because if you look at the metabolic changes that happen in a hibernating animal as winter is onsetting, you can see all those same changes in an obese human.
Hello, and welcome to the Get Lean, Eat Clean podcast. I'm Brian Grinn, and I'm here to give you actionable tips to get your body back to what it once was 5, 10, even 15 years ago. Each week, I'll give you an in-depth interview with a health expert from around the world to cut through the fluff and get you long-term sustainable results. This week, I interviewed evolutionary biologist Brad Marshall. We did a deep dive into human metabolism and Brad's new emergence diet, along with ways to test your metabolic rate, Brad's theory of eating low branched chain amino acids, supplements that may help improve your metabolism, how Brad decreased his fasting blood glucose, fats you should cook in, and much, much more. Really enjoyed my interview with Brad. I know you will too. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the show. All right. Welcome to the Get Lean, Eat Clean podcast. My name is Brian Grinn and I have Brad Marshall on. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to get into it.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on. I've listened to you through the years and I've checked out your Fire in a Bottle website and products. And so I'm curious what led you down this road. I know you've talked about your health journey in the past and your weight loss journey. Maybe give the audience a little bit of background of that and what led you to where you are now.
Right. Well, I'm fat. That's the thing. And
tell us really so, how it is.
And so so this has been a lifelong struggle, and I'm also happen to be a, you know, a molecular biologist trained at Cornell. I did cancer research at Memorial Sloan Kettering, so I have a very strong molecular biology background. I'm very interested in evolutionary biology, and so, you know, I'm sort of, and what I've always seen is that, like, to me, you know, everybody talks about, you know, obesity is about, you know, calories in, calories out, right? And when I look around the world and just watch, I'm an observer of, like, what people eat around me, right? I love food. I'm also a total foodie. I went to the French Culinary Institute. So those interests all kind of like dovetail into Fire in a Bottle world. And well, what I've always noticed is that there's some people, and I notice these people in my life who are just like the leanest people. Like there was one guy who was a great friend of mine in high school, and he wrestled in the 145 weight pound class, but really he was taller. He was like 5'11" and he was like, usually he actually weighed like 138 pounds. He couldn't even stay at 145 pounds. And that guy ate more calories than I've ever seen any. Like we'd go to this place in Clyde, New York. We'd go to the bowling alley because they had 25-cent wing night. No, maybe it was five. I think it was 5-cent wing night. This was the 90s. and he would get 40 chicken wings, 40. And he would just, they were gone in like 10 minutes. Like just this like ravenous, you know. So I see these people with these like ravenous, extraordinary metabolic rates. And then on the other side of the coin, you see these people that are trying to lose weight and they're like starving themselves and it's not working, right? And so when I look at those two individual groups, I'm like, clearly this is a metabolic rate issue. Like something isn't working right in this group of people that is working in this group of people. And that's not to say that we, you know, sure, maybe we shouldn't be eating all of our meals at McDonald's. You know, there certainly is an element of you know, Americans' dietary choices could be better for certain. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that explains the whole thing. You know, I think there's you see these clear changes historically in obesity patterns. We know that something's changed. Obviously, some of the things in the food system have changed. The oils that we use have changed. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, I'm very interested in the metabolic side. what causes the changes in metabolic rates, what, you know, what allows us to be insulin sensitive or not, what are the seasonal changes, what are the food changes, you know, what can we do with supplements to try to help, you know, anything we can do to give ourselves a lever, right, to kind of get metabolism going again, right? How do we, yeah.
Yes. It can be very complex, right?
And oh, it's extraordinarily complex.
Your weight loss journey, I know you've tried a lot of different things. It's almost like you're using yourself as like an experiment, would you say, to some degree?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Maybe, I know your new one, the Emergence Diet, we're going to get into that one soon, but what have you tried in the past and what are your thoughts around that?
Sure. So I've done keto a lot of times in my life, right? Like that had been my go-to. I noticed that keto didn't work as well. Like once I hit 40, keto was not as effective for me as a weight loss strategy. And I also felt like the problem with keto is that I could never stay on it. Like I can do it for 6 months. I can do it for a year, but inevitably, you know, I go away from it. And I just felt like, you know, again, thinking about people in my life, I'm like, when I think about all the people I know, there's at most 25% of them would ever do keto, right? Just knowing that person, like there's no more than one out of four that I could ever see doing keto, right? And so I started to think, one, I'm not sure keto is the best for long-term weight loss, and two, or just for sort of sustainability purposes, and two, like I think there's probably some other better strategies out there. And I'm also a huge proponent of things like, I mean, it's sort of a running joke with my friends that I've had there's this thing called the China Health Study. And it's like this, like, it's like 800 page long of just like the raw data, not the cheesy paperback novel that Colin Campbell wrote, but the actual data is like in this like lithograph. It's like 800 pages. And I bought it years ago for like $200 at a used bookstore. And it's sat on my coffee table for the last 25 years. And I'll open it up and flip through it and just started looking at some of these correlations of like different dietary trends, and very interesting. So anyway, so from that, reading that book, I was like, well, something obviously, you know, keto doesn't have all the answers because obviously you have all these people in China and they're eating all this rice and they're not obese. So obviously there's more to it than that. Right. And so that was the first thing. And then I did the croissant. So then I did the croissant diet because I was looking at the effects of something called stearic acid, which is a saturated fat. It's 18 carbon. It's a long chain. It's basically the longest chain length. You know, fats come in different lengths and different saturation levels, and stearic acid is the longest and most saturated of all the fats. And it's common in things like, cocoa butter, and it's common in things like beef suet, like the kidney fat of ruminants. And in mice, if you feed mice a diet that's all the fat is from stearic acid, they get lean. And so I thought I'd try it, and the mouse diet is like, you know, it's like 40% of the calories are from starch and a bunch of the calories are from the stearic acid. And I said, we could make croissants out of those. And so I made this very high stearic acid croissants and I started eating those, and it actually worked. You know, I lost inches off my waist. I lost a bunch of weight in a pretty short period of time. And so that was kind of a eureka moment that was like, okay, look, we can, you know, if we understand the science better, right, we can make more informed decisions about what might or might not work from a weight loss perspective. Because that, you know, the really interesting thing about the croissant diet is it wasn't really about macros. It was about, right, the types of fat. And then on and on. And so now,
when you did the croissant diet, is that pretty much, well, you said 40% of your calories were coming from the stearic acid. Is that so?
I would say 40% were coming from this, the starch, right? Cause it was, okay. I was making them with regular wheat flour, just all purpose flour. Right. So, I think the starch was about 40%. And then, the stearic acid on its own is like, it's like hard wax. You have to like, so I was mixing it with butter to get the croissants to where they were like edible, at least somewhat edible. They were still pretty waxy. So the fat was around, you know, 60%, but,
how long did you do it for?
I did that for about 6 weeks, I think. Okay. And I changed up towards the end. I was just making pancakes instead of croissants because croissants are a pain to make consistently.
Yeah. Imagine.
But yeah, so that was a very, that was a mixed, what we're now calling a swampy diet. This is a term that Denise Minger actually came up with that I stole from her, but she talks about, there's this great experiment that John Speakman did in mice. And they basically put mice on all these different diets and they raised the level of fat from like 10% of calories up to like 80% of calories. And what you see is that the mice that were the fattest were in the like 30 to 60% of calories from fat range. And the very low fat mice were leaner. And then the mice that were up at like 80% fat that were more on a ketogenic diet, like they were leaner. And so then the idea is that area from like 40 to 60% of calories as fat is the swampland. That's been become part of the language of the sort of a fire in a bottle. And there's also a discussion thread that's actually a really good discussion thread over on Reddit at r/saturated fat, where people talk about a lot of these things too. That's a good place if people are interested in this. But yeah, so the croissant diet really was a very swampy diet, which is interesting because, you know, there's evidence, right? And the standard American diet is exactly that, right? It's like 40% of calories from fat, I think 16% from protein, and then whatever's left, 40% ish, is carbohydrates, right? And some of that sugar and some of that starch, but that's kind of the classic, right? That's happens to be very similar to the diet that you can use to fatten up a mouse in the lab, is that, you know, biscuits, right? Toast with butter.
But what I think's interesting about like what you've done and with your, you know, your research through the years, as far as like looking at it from the lens of like a metabolic standpoint, because like you said about the calories in, calories out, like it's something that I've gone back and forth about, because, you know, there's a lot of, you know, authority figures per se, like we talked about, like, you know, Lane Norton and individuals who they just simplify it to that. But I just think calories in, calories out is just too simplified.
Yeah.
Because like you said, we all have a friend, right? I have a friend who actually just came over like a week or two ago, but I have him over like once a month. We play chess and I feed him. And when I tell you he eats like, and I'm bigger than him, I'm 185, you know, almost, you know, 5'11". He's right. Probably 145 and we're the same height. And he can eat three times as much as me and not see any of that.
Right. Yeah, totally. Like, absolutely. Yeah.
So where's this coming from? Well, he's obviously just burning through this, right? I mean, metabolic rate has got to be part of it, right?
Right. Yeah. And there's another very interesting paper also by John Speakman. He went to China and they studied people who were the leanest. And what they found out was that the leanest people had the highest resting metabolic rate and were the least active. Because their metabolic rate is so highly tuned that they're just shredding all their calories. And then like, they don't even have enough energy to then get off the couch, right? Like they're super lean, super high metabolic rate. And they just don't move that much. Yeah.
I'm sure you're familiar with like Dr. Ray Peet.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Cause like I've had Jay Feldman on, I don't know if you know Jay, or Georgie Dinkoff.
Yeah,
these are, so they both come on and talked about obviously body temperature, resting pulse, was it? There's a few, you know, a few different measures that you can sort of take on a daily basis to sort of get a feel for where you're at. Big one was body temperature.
Yeah, I do my body temperature all the time.
And have you found that correlating to anything?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I do a lot. I've tried a lot of different supplements, right? To see like, and yeah, some of them, really you see the difference. It's like, you know, I do like, I sell something on my blog called SEA, steroyl ethanolamide, and it's involved in kind of, the endocannabinoid system, and the endocannabinoid system actually has a lot of effects on your metabolic rate, your thyroid, and whatever. And so that, you know, I started taking that and I was taking probably more than I should have been. I was taking 1200 milligrams a day. And like my resting body temperature went over a period of about a week, went up to around 100. I was like, well, maybe this is too high.
Wow.
So I had to back off. Like I felt like I had a flu for like 2 weeks and I backed off and then you hit the right amount and you're like, okay, now it's kind of normal. But like, experimenting with, pyruvate is another one. So, you know, I talk a lot about redox balance, which is a scary sounding word. And, pyruvate is another one that can, sort of gives you a temporary boost in your redox state, makes you more oxidized, less reduced. It's essentially like getting more oxygen. And that one, the first time I tried it, I mean, my, you know, it was like after a meal, my temperature was at like 99.8 or something. And so there are things that really, you know, you can rapidly see the effects. And over time, I feel like, you know, with the things I'm doing and the changes I'm making, like, you know, when I first started, it was pretty common for my body temperature to be 97.5 or 97.3.
And are you measuring it like first thing in the, or like middle of the day, or is there a time to measure?
I kind of measure it whenever I think of it. You know, some days I'll measure it five times. Some days I don't think about it. It's pretty random. Okay. I'm not that regular of a person. This is a bit of a problem if you're a self-hacker, but that's what it is. And so, well, yeah, like in the morning, it's usually right around 98. But like an hour after a starchy meal, yesterday it was 99.2. Like, you know, an hour after a big breakfast, and you can feel it like when you become more aware of it, in response to certain meals, I can actually sort of feel myself start to sweat, like, you know, 15 minutes, half an hour after I've eaten. And then I'll check and reliably it'll be, you know, 98.6 at least. Sometimes higher. Often I'll get 98.8 is a very common post meal body temperature.
I was just gonna say, what would you say would be some, obviously you mentioned a few supplements, but like, what would you say some lifestyle? I don't know.
I think a lot of it is, all right, so the dietary choices make a huge difference, right? So, you know, starch is more thermogenic than fat, and protein is actually more thermogenic than starch, or at least it can be if you are good at burning protein. And so your food choices make a huge difference. And this is one of the things that turned me around, right? I said I used to be a keto guy, and now I'm much more starch based, or I'm very starch based at this particular moment. And one of the reasons for that is looking at a bunch of research. There's a super interesting recent paper where they show that So, without getting too deep into the weeds, your mitochondria redox balance is basically like how many electrons in there, which is really just energy, right? And people talk about like energy toxicity, right? And so What happens is your mitochondria get too reduced, and that just means there's too much energy in there. There's too much, they're trying to burn too much food all at once, and there's not enough oxygen. Like, I liken it to a carburetor. If anyone remembers carburetors, cars don't have them anymore, but the carburetor is the thing that mixes the gasoline and the air. And so what happens is if you put too much gasoline into your engine and not enough air, the whole thing bogs down. And that's when engines like backfire and you get black smoke coming out of the tailpipe and the thing isn't running right because you have too rich of a mix of fuel to air. And that is my favorite analogy for what happens in people's mitochondria, right? We're trying to send in too much fuel and there's not enough oxygen. And so there's this great study, and they were taking continuous blood samples of these people, and they had them eat a whole bunch of carbohydrates. And what they showed was that as they continued to burn carbohydrates, their mitochondrial redox balance became more oxidized, which is to say they were actually getting a better gas, you know, air fuel mixture in their mitochondria, basically, as they burned the carbohydrates. But what was even more interesting is that they had normal weight humans and overweight humans, and the overweight humans took a lot longer to, well, they had a worse balance to begin with. So they had this reductive stress or this pseudo hypoxia in their mitochondria to begin with, essentially a lack of oxygen. And it took them a lot longer to start to burn the glucose. And when they finally did, they never caught up to the lean people. The lean people had much more, you know, an oxidized state, much more oxidative.
They were better burners of glucose.
Okay. Yeah. And so, if the heavier people ate enough glucose, it did improve their mitochondrial redox state over the 2 hours of the experiment as they sat there and ate that glucose. And so I looked at that and I was like, well, that's actually, I mean, if you can get yourself to burn glucose, that's actually a pretty good lever to get yourself out of this energy toxicity state, this like low burning, low metabolic state, right? And so that experiment, as well as there's a whole bunch of experiments from the 80s and 90s where they were just doing these like massive carbohydrate overfeeding experiences, and they were putting people in these metabolic chambers. And there's some of them where they like,
this is
after the rice diet. This is like, okay. I don't even know why they were doing these, but they built these little metabolic chambers. That's like a tiny, it's like a studio apartment, but like all of the airflow is controlled. So you can live in there for like 10 days. And I don't know, somehow they pass the meals through, and you know, there's an air intake and an air outlet. And so they can very precisely determine, it's like a calorimeter. They can very precisely determine how much oxygen that you're burning and how much CO2 you're exhaling over the 10 days. And so they just fed these guys increasing amounts of carbohydrates. So to the end, after the 10 days, they were eating like 5,000 calories a day of like nearly pure carbohydrates. And what happened is the whole 10 days in these metabolic chambers, every day their metabolic rate increased. From the beginning to the end, their metabolic rate increased by 900 calories a day.
Really?
Just because they were consuming massive amounts of carbs, their metabolic rate increased by 900 calories a day is not a small amount.
No. I sort of have done that a little bit for experiment on myself, where I've increased my calories by like 600, and majority of that has been like fruit.
Right. Yeah.
Like just like, so I don't know what carbs they were eating. Do you know what carbs they were being?
I don't remember. It was a mix. It was a mix of starch and sugar, for sure. I couldn't tell you exactly, but, yeah. And so it was these kinds of experiments that got me thinking, you know, I should reconsider the starch thing. Cause I like starch, you know, I mean, obviously this was after the croissant diet. This is after a lot of things that incorporated some starch. Right. But I sort of hadn't gone all in on it yet. I was on the fence. And so I did a couple of days of like, I was like, right after I read these overfeeding experiments, I was like, okay, you know what? I was like, I am going to eat 1,000 grams of starch a day for a little while and just see what happens. Right. Because my keto brain is screaming, if you eat 1,000 calories of starch carbohydrate, I should say, you know, you're going to gain 20 pounds in a week, right? That's what my brain is saying, but I was like, I'm going to do it. And I went down to the grocery store and I bought like, you know, things that were like low fat and high in carbs. So I bought like pretzels, gummy bears.
You weren't holding back. So,
right. Well, I mean, my goal was, that's 4,000 calories of pure carbs. That's a lot of carbs. So I was like, if we're going for it, we're going for it. Right. And so, I think 2 days in a row, I ate 1,000 grams of carbs, and then, you know, and I kept it up for about a week. And by the end of the week, I was down to like 600 grams. Cause that's a lot, right? It's a lot to just continually.
Yeah.
Like
you must have been.
But I didn't gain any weight. That's the thing, right? Like everything in my sort of logical brain was like, if you do this, you know, you'll gain weight, but that didn't happen. And I was like, okay. And for me, that was like doing that experiment was like a mental shift of like, okay, let's more thoroughly consider this starch concept. Like what's happening here? Like there's a lot of evidence that there is some benefits to doing this. And yeah, that was what
what
turned
led
me
to
down
the,
that road.
Was that what led you to that emergence diet that you talked
about? Yeah, right. And so the emergence diet was right. So I was coming out of that, and the term emergence comes from torpor research. So this is where they look at animals that are hibernating, and so they go into and animals can go into a state of torpor without necessarily hibernating or even being hibernators. And torpor is a state where animals can shut down their metabolic rate or reduce their metabolic rate by up to 90%. Right. And, nice. and lots of different animals do this. There's like 177 mammals that are known to go into torpor, and we know how to induce it in lab mice. Mice are not a hibernating species, but you can put them into a temporary state of torpor. And so in the spring, when hibernating animals are coming out of their torpid winter slow metabolic state, this is called emergence. And so that's where the name of the emergence diet comes from. The idea is, you know, get out of this torpid low metabolic state that I think a lot of us, you know, I'm not necessarily saying like what I actually think, you know, I use torpor as an analogy, right? Because if you look at the metabolic changes that happen in a hibernating animal as winter is onsetting, you can see all those same changes in an obese human. And I'll just give you a few examples so people know I'm not just, so one of those is upregulated desaturase enzymes. So that's SCD1, and that is D6D or delta 6 desaturase and D5D delta 5 desaturase. And so these are all things that they desaturate your fats. They're involved in polyunsaturated fat metabolism and monounsaturated fat metabolism. And that's just a single example of something that you see is upregulated both in the mammalian state of torpor and in an obese human, right? And so that's an example. And so I'm thinking about ways of getting out of this torpor. And so I was looking at, I spent a lot of time, there's videos about this, the first emergence diet video that I did. If you go back on my videos on the Fire in a Bottle YouTube, I was looking at what do grizzly bears eat when they come out of, you know, when they come out of their lairs in the spring. What does a grizzly bear eat in the spring, right? As it's emerging from torpor. That's an interesting question. And they eat a lot of protein rich foods. They graze. So they're eating a lot of grass. People probably don't realize that grass is actually a pretty high protein food because there's not a lot of carbs and there's not a lot of fat. And so most what's left in there is so like, you know, it's like 30 things like clover, especially can be like 35% protein in the dry matter. You know, once you remove the water, I used to be a farmer. So I know a lot about forage analysis anyway. And so the bears are eating that and they're eating elk. They catch and kill like elk as they're born. So they have like elk and grasses and they eat some tubers. So they're getting some starch and they're getting some sugar out of the tubers and the grass has some starch and sugar. But it's a pretty high protein diet. And so I talked in those videos about, you know, the advantages of protein and the advantages of whey. And I tried for a little while. I did another experiment. I was like, okay, well, let's try this concept of a really high protein diet, right? I went out, I got a bag of whey powder. I went out, I got boneless, skinless chicken breasts, and I got a bunch of salad greens, right? I was like, okay, well, I'm a grizzly bear. It's spring. I'm eating this lean meat. I'm eating all this lettuce, these green things. And it just didn't work. It just didn't work. But in the process of making those videos, I also, in looking at protein, I also ran across this other really interesting research coming out of the Lamming lab. And they were actually restricting protein in mice. And they were showing that by restricting branched chain amino acids, they were restoring these metabolisms. They were restoring the metabolism of these mice. And I was like, man, that's really interesting. It's sort of backwards from what you expect. But then I was like, but wait a minute. We're talking about the bears in the spring once they've woken up. What were they doing in the months before that? Well, they're living off their own body fat, which is obviously a high fat diet, but they're also not metabolizing protein in that time period. And so then I was like, okay, well, let's play with that. And so, and I actually posted, I think it was in that same video where I posted about, well, the grizzly bears are eating all this protein. I posted as an aside, oh, but there's this interesting counter research of the lambing lab. And look, they fixed these mice lost all this weight on a branched chain amino acid restricted diet. Well, anyway, out of that video, some of the people on the r/saturated fat message board on Reddit saw that and they started doing it. They started restricting protein. And all of a sudden people were like, no, this really works. Like, this is great. Like, my blood glucose is down. I'm losing weight by actually restricting these branched chain amino acids. And branched chain amino acids, by the way, are high in most sources of dietary protein. So they're high in muscle meats. They're high in plant proteins, but they're very low in connective tissues. So they're very low in
collagen,
you know, collagen, pork rinds, pig's feet, beef tendon, things like that. And so, and I also had known that there was a lot of advantages to these connective tissues. They have a lot of glycine, for instance. That's the main amino acid. And glycine, it turns out, there's a sort of a landmark paper from 1969 where they just measured circulating amino acids in normal weight humans and obese humans. And what they showed is that the obese humans have high circulating branched chain amino acids and they have low circulating glycine. And just in the past few years, another paper came out that said, well, actually the high branched chain amino acids are actually causing the lowered glycine. And what the glycine is doing is it is in your muscle tissues. Glycine is actually used to bind to a lot of the unburnt fuel. So like when I was talking about energy toxicity and, you know, your metabolism isn't burning cleanly, you've got this unburnt fuel, the glycine actually helps remove that unburnt fuel from your skeletal muscle. And so it looks like the branched chain amino acid and the glycine are kind of these,
you know, counteract each other, sort of.
Or? They counteract each other, and the branched chain amino acids are a signal to be anabolic, right? They activate mTOR, and if you're a weightlifter and you want to add bulk, branched chain amino acids are a great way to do that, right? Which is why guys use whey powder in the gym. On the other hand, if you're fat, you probably don't want to be anabolic because mTOR controls both protein anabolism as well as fat anabolism, right? So mTOR can make you add muscle. It can also make you add fat, right? So if you're in the state, if your metabolic state is set up to add fat, well, if you eat a lot of whey powder, your body's just going to pack on more fat, right? Because that's what you're optimized to do, right? And so, so all these threads were coming together, and I was like, well, I mean, you know, I ran a butcher shop, right? And I ran a pig farm, and I've always loved pork skin, any dish that has like crispy pork skin or pig's feet, and I would have these parties and make all my friends eat the pig's feet. and so to me, I was like, well, what if we combined? I mean, everybody knows that broth is good. And then, you know, again, you can look in mouse studies and you can see that indeed there are a lot of metabolic benefits to supplementing with glycine. If you feed mice a lot of like collagen peptides, you can reverse a lot of the effects of diet induced obesity. And I said, well, I mean, this makes sense, right? Like, from all of the ways, right? I'm like, first off, if you think about traditional diets, you're like, okay, well, potato soup, right? That's bone broth and potatoes. That's starch and gelatin. And that's something that is, right? That's a traditional food around the world in all kinds of different cultures, you know? And, you know, in Africa, they might make it with cassava or yam instead of potato, but essentially you can find that same dish. You know, there's a dish in Latin America that's cassava and pork rinds, cassava and crispy pork rinds. It's served cold. It's like a salad, but it's a very classic dish, right? And so I started to see this combination of kind of collagen and starch
Interesting.
Being this thing, this being this global thing, if you look back at historical food diets and it tastes good and they seem to complement each other. And so I thought, you know, if I just cup, and I've always been a meat eater, right? I was the whole time that I've been trying all these different diets and sort of, I was struggling with high fasting blood glucose.
You know, I just want to add one thing. I just actually got a big blood panel and everything was pretty solid, but I've always had high fasting blood glucose, like not crazy, but anywhere from like 95 to low 100s. And I was like, I never really understood that, why yeah. that was. I don't know if there's a correlation, but it's just the one thing that I was like, oh. Well,
so yeah. I was classically, my number would be 115, right? Okay. And so, and it would, like you say, that's not crazy high, but it's high. It's considered pre-diabetic, right? And so I knew that, well, I was reasonably certain, right, that the high fasting blood glucose was linked with the you know, this mitochondrial state of reductive stress or pseudohypoxia or, you know, energy toxicity, whatever you want to call it. They're all kind of the same thing. Yeah. And so I tried, you know, 10 different approaches to try to solve that. One of which was like, you know, some of the supplements, alpha lipoic acid. I use R alpha lipoic acid is my, if people are like, if I was going to take one supplement, what would it be? I would tell them to take that one because it's essentially adding, it's oxygenating your mitochondria. And so
that's R L A L A.
Yes. Yeah. R alpha lipoic acid. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I tried that and I tried the, you know, my SEA, in combination, thinking that those two things together should help the blood glucose. And they like kind of maybe helped a little. And I tried different diets and I'd get it. Some days I was getting like better readings, like 105, you know, but still not great. Right. And so I started the emergence diet, October 2nd, I think, or 1st of,
last year.
Mm-hmm. And 10 days later, my blood glucose was
80.
Well, 10 days later, it was in the low 90s. Like I was getting like, and it was going down to, it was like 97 one day. And then the next day it was 96. And like the day after that, it was like 93. And then within another week or two after that, it was 80. And now every day when I wake up, 80, 81, 75.
And that's just from combining starch and like bone broth or gelatin.
So, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
But I'm doing I'm very specifically restricting branched chain amino acids. So, so what I'm doing now is a lot of low protein starches, you know, and it's confusing, right? Because, when you look at the mice in the lab, the ones that are right when they did this, like sort of protein restriction, if you get them down to 5% protein in their diet, like they're very high metabolic rates. Very like it, and it's fixing a lot of these things, and they're not using collagen, right? They're not using gelatin. And so my goal, sort of, and this is sort of a moving target, right? I'm figuring out, I was like, well, like I don't want to be at 5% protein, but I want the branched chain amino acid containing parts of the diet to be at 5% protein. And so that means, you know, like, muscle meats, grains, potatoes, most starches are already at 10%. So rice, potatoes are already at 10%. Corn's at maybe 8 or 9%. And
of branched chain amino acids?
Well, I'm talking about those are right. Let me clarify that what I just said. So that's total protein, right? So they're at around 10% total protein. Okay. The mice did very well at 5% total protein. But I'm just equating the fact that muscle meats and grains all have about the same amount of branched chain amino acids. They're all right around 17%, and it doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter the protein from a filet beef has the same percentage of branched chain amino acids as rice, and grains have more protein than people think they do. Right. So it's like, if you're doing a starch-based diet and you're eating rice all day and you eat 2000 calories of rice, well, at the end of the day, you're like, well, that's, you know, you add it up, right? That's 400 grams of rice. You're like, well, that's still 60 grams of protein or something that's coming from the rice. And so if you actually want to get down to that kind of like 5% that the mice were fed of, essentially, basically what I mean is 5% is all protein, not including connective tissues, not including collagen. So I probably will do 5% of my calories as protein from collagen, plus 5% of protein from sources of starch, et cetera. Or it's probably never really five. It's probably more like seven. But the way I get down to that seven is I'm using things like cassava and I'm using some plantain, because cassava is like 3% protein. Whereas, you know, rice is 9, potatoes are 11. Right. And so that's what I've been playing with. And I've been using like cassava flour, like the pancakes that I use in the morning are cassava flour pancakes, which is like, there's almost no protein in cassava. It's like the purest natural source of starch in the world.
Would you say that, because I remember talking to, I think Georgie even about this, he's talked about this sort of glycine to,
right.
What am I missing?
Glycine. Yes. To, so, right.
And this ratio, is a ratio. Yeah.
This is a repeat concept. And right. I think repeat was exactly right on this. I think repeat nailed this. And like, and that's what I'm incorporating here is
what's
to get
the ratio.
That.
What's the ratio I'm thinking of, glycine to,
I mean, yeah, it's basically glycine to branched chain amino acids, I think.
Okay.
I don't know. My understanding of what Ray Pete said was that, and I'm not a Ray Pete scholar. I haven't read a lot of his things. I know tangentially a lot of what he said. But my understanding is he was saying basically you should get equal amounts of protein from collagen as you do from muscle meats. And so that would actually put you at right around a 1-to-1 ratio of glycine to branched chain amino acids. And so it's very possible that, you know, I'm restricting branched chain amino acids and I'm upping glycine. It's possible that someone could get similar results keeping their protein levels, you know,
somewhat normal, because
somewhat yeah. normal, but just increasing the glycine a lot, you know, or increasing the collagen a lot.
That would be another maybe experiment, because like you said, like I'm my wife and I, we enjoy having meat.
Oh, sure.
Mainly, you know, let's say ribeye or filet, but you get some collagen from the fattier meats, right? You're getting some connective tissue or not.
You know, it's funny. I've spent tons of time going through the literature and looking at these studies and thinking like, well, beef shank has to be like loaded with collagen, and it is higher. But it's not so much higher as you want it to be or as you expect it to be. Some of the seafoods are better, like scallops okay. are very good, are higher in collagen. You know, that scallop muscle is a weird, it's almost like a connective tissue / muscle thing. Like, so there are some like random ones out there. But
would you say the best way to get them is through bone broth?
Bone broth is a great way to get it. I mean, everybody likes bone broth. And
do you make your own? Because it is expensive.
I don't. Okay. I should. I used to run a butcher shop. We had this 60-gallon kettle, and that was like one of our huge products. We wholesaled bone broth across the Northeast. So I'm I'm good at making bone broth, but you know, it's a process. It's messy, and So I've been buying mine, unfortunately.
You've been buying the bone broth. And is this different than just getting a collagen protein, correct? Or is it?
Well, the composition are all pretty similar, right? So there's you can buy just collagen protein supplements. That's fine. There's bone broth, you know, pork rinds. Like there's the brands of baked pork rinds that aren't fried in vegetable oils. I mean, those are great sources of collagen. You know, if you want to have something that's like real food that you actually chew, you know, and I literally, there's an Asian store in Ithaca now, a big Asian supermarket that's opened, and you can buy the beef tendons. They're fantastic. They're just the tendon meat, and you just slow simmer them, and I think it's delightful. You know, it's is it as good as ribeye? I mean, probably not, but it's at least it's something that is you know, I think it's great. I put it in pasta sauce. I put it in all kinds of things. I've been making cassava gnocchi.
Oh, wow. That's a first.
The fun thing about this diet is it gives me the option to sort of like express the like chef side of my background. So I'm like, oh, I can make cassava gnocchi and beef tendon pasta sauce, you know, and it's like, oh, I'm running a fancy bistro now.
And would you say like there's a lot of collagen powders out there. Are some that you steer towards than other ones, like, or you don't?
I don't, you know, okay. I don't, I got some collagen from, Carnivore Aurelius. He's online. He's got stuff that's from, Brazilian. It's all from Brazilian grass fed beef. So that seemed like a pretty safe source. So I've been using that, but that's honestly the only thing that I've tried. I got it. It's lasted me till now.
Yeah, because I think finding that balance, because I do, you know, like we said, you enjoy meat, and it's like maybe a way to sort of do what you're doing, but maybe not to the extent of just getting rid of all muscle meats is by upping the collagen part of it.
Right. Yeah, sure. And I do little tricks. Like I'll make like a meat sauce, but it's like mostly I'll take like 4 ounces of ground beef at the beginning and just brown it up. And then you make the meat sauce with that. And it, you know, it gets you that meaty flavor and that whatever there is to the thing that is satisfying about eating muscle meats. I feel like I can get that cleverly with using smaller amounts. And that's sort of what I've been shooting for. You know, things like prosciutto give you like, you know, a little bit of that flavor kind of goes a long way. So there's clever ways to sort of like, you know, use your protein budget wisely or whatever. But
so let's just touch on a few more things. The emergence diet seems pretty cool. So I'm sure you're going to post updates now how things are going for you with that.
Oh yeah.
What else would you say is top of mind? I mean, I know you've talked in the past about, obviously we've talked on this podcast about vegetable oils in general.
Right.
You know, I don't know if we need to go down that rabbit hole, but what about, I know you talked with Paul a little bit about the Inuit and like long-term ketosis. What are your thoughts around that?
Yeah. Well, so that's a weird topic. And it's a little bit complicated. So, there's this longstanding question. So the Inuit, as probably most listeners know, you know, they live in the far north. There's no plant foods available. They mostly eat whale blubber and seal blubber and things like trout and whitefish and these northern fish. But they have this genetic change that almost all of the Inuit have that you don't see in adjacent areas, even though the adjacent areas are like far northern Canada, where they also don't really have plant foods. And this mutation means that they can't go into ketosis. And the mystery is why, or they can't go into high levels of ketosis. And the mystery is why is it that the Inuit have selected for this genetic mutation that keeps them out of ketosis? And some people have said, well, this proves that ketosis isn't a healthy
long-term solution.
I'm not a particular fan of ketosis, as you probably got from the beginning of the video, but I don't think that's right either. I don't think that has anything to do with the Inuit's dietary change. If that were true, then the other native peoples in northern Canada who are just eating like elk and caribou would also have that mutation, right? But they don't have that mutation. So I think it has to do with the marine oils, and specifically, so there's something called PPAR alpha, and it controls our, people say it's a master controller of fat metabolism. It sort of is, sort of isn't. What it is a master controller of is fat detoxification, fat desaturation. And so what I believe is that that amount of marine oils are not super safe for humans. So in a mouse, what happens is marine oils, omega-3 fats, they activate PPAR alpha. And PPAR alpha is involved in all of the detoxification pathways. And PPAR alpha says, oh, this is omega-3s. These look dangerous. We need to get rid of them. In the mouse, what happens is they massively upregulate their peroxisomes. And so peroxisomes are a place that you can send fats and you can break them down. And they're a little bit kind of safer than sending them into the mitochondria. And so in a mouse, they'll be like, okay, we got to get rid of these omega-3 fats. They have this like 10x increase in their peroxisomal activation, and they just send them there and it's fine. And so what happens is we take a mouse in the lab that doesn't have, it's a null genetic mutation that we made in the lab that doesn't have the gene PPAR alpha. And if you give them fish oil, they're dead in about 10 days because fish oil is toxic to your liver. Like they die of acute liver failure because they can't get rid of these omega-3s, and these long chain omega-3s are going to cause all kinds of, they cause all kinds of problems in your liver if you can't detoxify them. And the problem is that humans somewhere along the line lost our ability to surge our peroxisomal activity in the same way that rodents do. And so if you give, PPAR actually stands for peroxisome proliferator. And so it's something that increases activity of peroxisomes, but in humans, this doesn't really work. And that's probably, has something to do that we were primates. Primates don't eat a lot of polyunsaturated fats. They maybe don't eat a lot of these other plant toxins or whatever. And so somewhere along the line, we lost that ability, and it didn't bother us too much, and life went on and it was all fine. Right. So then these Inuits go to the Arctic, and now they're eating all of this fish oil and marine oils. And this is probably not a very safe combination for humans. But yet they can't gin up all of this peroxisomal activity, and they're sending all this fish oil into their mitochondria. And so they actually developed a mutation that they can't send long chain fats into their mitochondria because they have a defect in what's called CPT1. And so what's happening is basically they just said, okay, well, since we can't increase our peroxisomes, we're just going to not send any long chain fat into the mitochondria. And that's going to force our peroxisomes to do the work anyway, right? Because now the fats will build up. And even though the peroxisomes aren't 10x surging, it's still going to push them, right? Just the fact that they have more substrate available, they're going to work harder. They're going to do more of the load. And so it's essentially that the mutation they have, I think, is a way to take the load of these long chain omega-3 fats off of the mitochondria and stick them back into the peroxisomes, which is really where you want to send these long chain PUFA. But, so that's my theory. This is just my conjecture.
This is your theory. So you're not a fan. Jade Feldman's not a fan of omega-3s, like supplementation or even through consumption. Is that where you lie?
With a small caveat, I think there is some, a lot of the problems, like I say, that we see in torpor, that we see in obesity is this desaturation system of D6D and D5D. And there is some negative feedback of DHA, which is the longest, most unsaturated omega-3. Biological systems work in these pathways, and often the end product shuts off the enzyme that's making the end product because, there's already enough of it there, right? And so we have all these feedback loops, negative feedback loops that are stopping the thing that's making the thing that's building. Otherwise, you would just make it forever. The DHA seems to have a pretty potent effect at negatively feeding back on that chain of omega-3 desaturation. And so DHA, I think, especially if you can get it in phospholipid form, is something that I think it's probably good. The other omega-3s, I would say avoid, especially avoid alpha-linolenic acid, the plant-based omega-3. Our body hates that fat. Our body does everything in its power to get rid of that fat as fast as possible. So to me, that's not...
Where do we get most of that from?
I mean, flax seeds are a really good, are a big source of that. Obviously, like, but people supplement flax seeds, right? Like canola oil is probably for most people, just in their not trying to supplement linolenic acid, canola oil would be a big source. Also, soybean oil is like 7% alpha linolenic acid. And so, yeah, some of the use, I mean, probably for most people, the largest source of alpha linolenic acid is soybean oil, in America.
Because every restaurant you go into is cooking with it and heating it.
And it's in every, you know, if snack you go food. Through the snack food, it's in every snack food too, you know. Yeah.
So what are you cooking? Coconut oil? Or
Well, these days I'm doing pretty low fat cooking on the emergence diet. So I'm doing a lot more like boiling. I'm doing a lot of like, you know, boiling things in bone broth. But when I do cook, I use butter. I mean, if I am going to use a cooking pad, I use butter. That's my go-to. You know, my other go-to would be beef suet. Beef suet is another hot, very high, stearic acid. So beef suet, the kidney fat specifically of ruminants, are the highest fats in stearic acid. Butter is the most saturated fat. You know, we have this whole confusing, language around fats, right? It's like, oh, well, lard is saturated. Well, not really. It's 40% saturated. You know, what other thing is 40% of something? And people are like, oh, that's totally that. And it's like, no, it's not. It's less than half. It's like well under half. So right. Like, whereas butter is like 70% saturated. So butter is an actual saturated fat. It's the only one really. Beef fat is, 40 to 50% saturated. But then the beef suet can be approaching the levels of butter. It can be like 60 to 65% saturated and maybe 20 to 25% stearic acid. And so that beef suet, but if you want to keep, so my sort of thing about I like saturated fat. I feel like saturated fat is what our body makes. And saturated fat to me is kind of neutral. It doesn't really act as a signaling molecule. It's just kind of like diesel fuel. It's there. It doesn't really do much. It's just kind of a source of calories, right? Whereas if you look at monounsaturated fats, like you know, when you eat monounsaturated fats, well, you're activating PPAR alpha. And that has all kinds of downstream effects. It's clearly involved in the progression of obesity. It actually activates delta 6 desaturase and delta 5 desaturase. So the more monounsaturated fats you eat, you're activating these desaturase enzymes, which, you know, is maybe a problem if you're eating it with starch. And then when you get into the polyunsaturated fats, well, they're the things that are actually getting desaturated by delta 6 desaturase and delta 5 desaturase, right? And so it's like they're kind of the yin and yang in my mind of metabolic dysfunction. And so, so I go with butter, which is 70% saturated, and there's nothing in there that I'm really scared of. Or beef suet's good.
And ghee? Ghee's okay too, right?
Yeah, ghee's clarified butter. Just butter without the milk protein, which is especially good if you are
lactose.
If you're allergic to dairy, ghee is a good option. You know, butter doesn't have lactose in it, right? Lactose is the sugar. So, and butter's very low in protein. I mean, there's not a lot of protein in butter, but if you have a legitimate allergic reaction to dairy, then, ghee is a better source than a better choice than butter. Or also just, from restaurant supply stores, you can buy clarified butter. Ghee is, when they make ghee, they brown the butter solids first. So it's this long, slow cooking process. they make like, if you've ever seen like brown butter, they basically make that.
My wife just made these brown butter chocolate chip cookies.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And brown butter, it has its place and it's great. But like, because of the fact that that's how ghee is traditionally made, ghee has a very specific flavor profile.
Yeah.
If you buy clarified butter from a restaurant supply store, it's essentially the same thing as ghee, but it doesn't have that brown butter step. So the flavor is a little bit more just like regular butter. FYI, people who are shopping for butter.
I've been cooking in coconut oil. But that's okay, right? I mean, that's been,
yeah. So coconut oil, right? So I have a very I'm still trying to figure out coconut oil. I actually did a coconut oil thing last summer, I guess, and to me it was a fail. I tried it for a pretty long time. The issue with, so coconut oil is all saturated. The problem for me with coconut oil is the main fat is lauric acid, which is 12 chain saturated fat, and that is another thing that activates PPAR alpha because essentially any fat, I think what PPAR alpha's role is to get rid of the types of fats that the body doesn't want to store. And so we don't store a lot of lauric acid, right? So when you consume lauric acid, you're kind of forced to either metabolize it right away, or you have to like turn on the de novo lipogenesis machinery and you have to break it down because we can't, you know, it's funny, the fats that we eat, a lot of them, if they activate PPAR alpha, what happens is we break them down and into acetyl-CoA. So, you know, fats are made out of these two carbon units called acetyl-CoA, and you just link them together like a chain. And like when you eat, especially alpha-linolenic acid from, you know, which is the plant-based omega-3, if humans eat this within 24 hours throughout the body, if you label that, if you put a radio label on that alpha-linolenic acid throughout the body in 24 hours, you're finding it in palmitic acid all over the body. And what that means is that, and palmitic acid is saturated, right? And we can't remove double bonds from alpha. We can't make alpha-linolenic acid into saturated fat. So what happens, you eat ALA, it triggers PPAR alpha, it upregulates the machinery to do de novo lipogenesis, and it upregulates the rate at which fat is flooding into the mitochondria. And so the mitochondria gets overwhelmed with all of this fat flooding in and all this acetyl-CoA, and it gets rebuilt into palmitic acid, right? And that really is the job of PPAR alpha. And so, you know, when I talk about, you know, our basic problem being this energy toxicity or overload of fuel in the mitochondria, anytime that you activate PPAR alpha, you're adding to that. And so the PPAR alpha is saying, okay, we can't store any of this fat, send it all in the mitochondria, break it down and rebuild it as something that we can store, rebuild it into palmitic acid, rebuild it into, you know, stearic acid, oleic acid. That's what comes out of de novo lipogenesis. Right. And so I think that that's a problem with coconut oil to me, is that 12 cup chain. And of course that process, every time that you're turning on that machinery of de novo lipogenesis.
Yeah, go ahead.
Now you eat a potato with that, and the glucose, of course, also gets converted to acetyl-CoA, and it also just gets rebuilt into that fat, right? Because you have all these enzymes, and they're just, the more acetyl-CoA that's around, the more they're gonna just churn out fat, and now it doesn't, right? And so because that system is upregulated, essentially everything, protein, glucose, fat, it's all going to get rebuilt into these fats.
I've been sauteing my potatoes in coconut oil.
Having said that, like there are a lot of interesting things about coconut oil. Like I say, like I tried it and last summer. It's a very interesting fat, and there's a lot of benefits. And the fast burning of the MCTs is interesting. I think that the 14 carbon fat in coconut oil, we can actually store that. And so what happens long term, what you see is that, you know, in societies where they eat mostly coconut oil, they actually have the most saturated fat out of any society. And what happens is that saturated fat displaces the monounsaturated fat and the polyunsaturated fat
right.
in their tissue. And it's mostly that a lot of it is the 14 carbon myristic acid. And so that's super interesting. And I think if there was a way to capture that and do it in the long term, I think that's a really interesting approach. And that was why I tried doing it for a long time. It didn't work for me. But coconut oil is super saturated. And so it's, you know, I'm on the fence about it. I'm not going to say okay. don't eat coconut
so
oil.
So don't throw it out. Okay.
Yeah. I'm just,
you're on the fence.
I'm on the fence. Yeah.
Because butter is okay. If it's even in higher heats, it's okay to use butter. I mean,
yeah. I mean, okay. I saute with butter. I mean, I wouldn't deep fry in butter.
Yeah. Right.
But for just general sauteing and general cooking, I think it's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that's the classic. You know.
I'll switch to that. I don't mind it. I don't mind it at all. I just had a big tub of coconut. I'm like, I got to use this somehow.
Sure.
So now I'll just send it to you. I'll mail it to you.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, this was fun, Brad. I feel like we could keep going. Maybe we'll do a part two down the road. Maybe I'll get you and Georgie on. I think that'd be really fun.
Yeah, that's fun. Georgie and I did a show together. Maybe a year or two ago now on, Georgie and I got along really well. It was a fun show.
Yeah. That'd be a lot.
I have my differences from Georgie, I'm sure. And he thinks about these problems in a very different realm of, you know, he focuses a lot on the corticoid system and a lot of the thyroid stuff and
the stress response. And
right. And that's not where my brain is. My brain is a little more low level and like, how do the various macros affect flows of energy in and out of the mitochondria? Mm-hmm. So there is kind of overlapping.
Be a lot of talking. It'd have to be at least a two hour show. Both you guys. Yeah. And I'd say about five words, which would be fine. But this was fun, Brad. I appreciate you coming on the show. Where's the best place for people to find what you're doing?
So the blog fireinabottle.net. I don't update as often as I did because I've been focusing a lot more on the YouTube channel, which is just Fire in a Bottle on YouTube. I'm relatively often on Twitter, which is fire_bottle. I've been trying to push more videos onto Instagram. I'm fire_in_a_bottle. And I think that's the same. I have a TikTok channel now. That's a very new, not a lot of followers yet, but I'm dipping my toe into that water to see how it goes. And then I've already mentioned it, but the Reddit discussion thread at r/saturatedfat is a good place. There's a very active community there and they're pretty smart group of people. They can help you guys out in a lot of ways. If you head over there, so
on Reddit. Okay. And then I do want to ask you one last question that I ask pretty much all my guests. If you were going to give one tip to an individual that was looking to get their body back to what it once was, what one tip would you give that individual?
Oh man, that's a tough one. I would say this, and the reason that I'm saying this is that, cause this is like made a big shift in my thoughts over the last year is to just reconsider starch and reconsider, like, you know, because I think that like carbohydrates in general and starch have obviously taken a lot of bad publicity. And I'm now thinking like maybe we should reconsider, maybe that should be sort of the sort of dietary cornerstone, which was the case traditionally. If you look at classic America, for the 100 years preceding the year 2000 or the forever, essentially, like America and European diets and African diets, they're largely starch based, and that has worked for a long time. Right. And a lot of the metabolic dysfunction that we've seen has happened in the last 100 years as we've sort of moved away from that. So, that might be my piece of sage advice for the world.
Love it. Love it. Well, thank you, Brad. I appreciate it. And have a great rest of the day. I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Get Lean, Eat Clean podcast. I understand there are millions of other podcasts out there and you've chosen to listen to mine, and I appreciate that. Check out the show notes at briangrin.com for everything that was mentioned in this episode. Feel free to subscribe to the podcast and share it with a friend or family member that's looking to get their body back to what it once was. Thanks again and have a great day.